every day hustle and hard and still live poor and low wage. You know, 1/3 of all poor folk live in the South. One of the movements that actually helped to get to UAW was when we challenged Smithfield in the South, in North Carolina, and won, brought poor, low-wage, black, white, Latinos together in a small Tar Heel, North Carolina. Nobody ever heard about it. And they said we couldn't win. We have to go to these states, because what we say, for instance, in the South, we say those are red states, but we don't know what color those states are because we've not really mobilized. 1/3 of all poor people live in the South. There's not a state in the South where if you mobilize 25% of poor and low-wage workers, that it would not change the outcome. In Florida, the percentage is under 3% of those infrequent voters. In North Carolina, it's under 19%. In Georgia, it's under 7%. All over the South and all over the country. In Wisconsin, it's less than 1%. So we, even in our language, and we have to say poor and low-wage workers, there's not a state in this country we call battleground state where the margin of victory was within 3% for the presidential election, that poor and low-wage workers don't make up 40% of the electorate. There's not a state in this country where poor and low-wage workers don't make up over 30% of the electorate. This is not also about the system, but it is also about poor and low-wage people grabbing their power and understanding the power that we have not used. Remember, it was Dr. King in 1965 at the end of the Selma to Montgomery March who said the greatest fear of the racist aristocracy in this country would be for the masses of Negroes and the masses of poor white working folk to come together and form a voting bloc that could fundamentally deal with the economic architecture of this country. You know, I've just released a book called White Poverty, and it's looking through the lies and the mythology pushed down by the Southern strategy to literally divide poor and low-wage black and white people as a way of continuing to exacerbate the divisions of race and class. This is a power move for poor and low-wage folk, poor and low-wage folk, religious leaders and allies. And lastly, one of the things Sean did with UAW is he made it a moral issue. He lifted it up and said, this is not, it's a class issue, it's an issue about working, but it's a moral issue. And when he framed it that way, it actually helped more people to grab on what he was saying.
Bishop Barber, before we go, I wanted to turn to a different issue. We just have a minute, and I wanted to ask you about the moral case for a ceasefire that you've written about in Gaza. In November, you joined a group of Christian leaders for a vigil outside the White House demanding President Biden support a ceasefire in Gaza and said, quote, we must join forces with Jews and Christians and Muslims around the world who are calling for a ceasefire in Gaza and the safe return of all hostages and civilian prisoners and to stop the killing. Your final thoughts on this as Israel weighs a full-scale invasion of Rafah?
We should, all moral leaders needed to say no to what Hamas did to children and women, and no, no, no to what Israel, the Israeli government, and Netanyahu is now continuing to do. In the original argument I wrote about Hamas, I also challenged the apartheid state that the Netanyahu regime had had in Israel. We said we must speak as one voice, Christians, Muslims, and Jews, to say the indiscriminate killing of women and children in this war is immoral. And let me give you a scripture straight from the text that, Muslims, Jews, and Christians all agree on. It's Isaiah 10. It ought to be a framework for how we move forward. Woe unto those who legislate evil and rob the poor of their rights and make women and children prey, P-R-E-Y. That is a moral text from the ancient Hebrew scriptures that Muslims and Christians all agree on. And it is a prophetic challenge to governments. And that must be our prophetic challenge to what Netanyahu and them are doing today.
Bishop William Barber, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, speaking to us from Durham, North Carolina. And Michael Zweig, economist and author of Class, Race, and Gender, Challenging the Injuries and Divisions of Capitalism. Bishop Barber wrote the introduction. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Gesder, Messiah Rhodes. Happy birthday, Messiah. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
nuclear holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, we ask the question, is the Israeli-Palestinian war about to become a wider war involving many more nations?
Our guest on this topic explains where the war has already spread and why there is great danger of it spreading even further.
Then we'll look to the results of the most recent UN gathering of nations addressing the climate change crisis.
Our guest, an expert on this topic, will argue that while the situation remains bleak, there is still much reason for hope. Stay with us.
I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
One issue flowing from the Israeli-Palestinian war, at first pretty much ignored, is the danger of the war widening. And as Israel's war in Gaza drags on with no end yet in sight, the threat of such a much wider war does grow stronger and stronger. Already the war has resulted in military action in Syria and Iraq by forces loyal to Iran. U.S. military facilities have been targeted in Iraq by Iranian-backed forces. The United States and Great Britain are now regularly bombing Houthi military installations in response to the Houthis militarily disrupting the free flow of shipping in the Gulf region on behalf of their support for Palestine. And there are now daily clashes between Hezbollah in Lebanon and Israel across their shared border. So far, the adversaries have been careful to not go beyond an unspoken but generally recognized tipping point or red line so as to not bring about open nation-on-nation warfare throughout the region. But a slippery slope has now been created that many fear could bring about what would amount to a world war, even if confined only to that part of the world. And if that happens, who knows how many other nations in the Middle East would end up drawn into such a wider war. So to help us understand and evaluate this threat of a much wider war resulting from the Israeli-Palestinian war, we're fortunate to have with us as our guest today an expert on that region of the world. Our guest is Richard Becker. Mr. Becker is the Western Regional Coordinator of the Act Now to Stop War and End Racism Coalition, or ANSWR. He is the author of the highly praised book, Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire, published in 2013 and with an updated edition of the book about to be released as well. He is also the author of the book entitled The Myth of Democracy and the Rule of the Banks. And Richard Becker is a national leader in the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Richard Becker, a warm welcome to the Law and Disorder Show.
Well, great. Thanks for having me, Jim.
Absolutely. So far, every one of the nations who've become involved in any ways in what we might call the wider war with respect to the Israeli-Palestinian war have entered the war or playing a role in the war on behalf of the Palestinian cause. They're taking military actions against Israel and the U.S., or in the case of the Houthis from Yemen, against Great Britain as well. The case of North Korea, they are actually providing weapons to Hamas in Gaza. Yeah, should this surprise us, really, or should the leaders of Israel and the U.S. and Great Britain have expected these other nations might become involved in whatever degree and on behalf of the Palestinian cause? And in that regard, I can't help but wonder to what extent is how the war is being conducted and how long it is dragging on Does it not have something to do with Netanyahu's own dire political and legal situation within Israel itself? His popularity is at an all-time low. They're calling for new leadership, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that's a mouthful of a question, so work away at it, my friend.
Well, I would say, first of all, that, you know, Netanyahu is both acting out of personal interest. That is, he wants the war to go on and on. He wants an expanded war, I think. I don't think there's much question about that. And whether he can have a wider war, you know, the U.S. has a lot to say about that. What is happening today is really a continuation of what's been going on since 1948, which is the dispersal, the removal, the transfer is the word that the Zionists who formed the State of Israel like to use, the transfer of the population, the Palestinian population, out of Palestine. We see that in the continuation of the war at the behest of Netanyahu and his refusal to acknowledge any rights for the Palestinian people. These things fit together. As far as the earlier part of what you were saying, you know, in the entire Arab world, and much broader than that, but let me just say about the Arab world, the many Arab countries, the population is overwhelmingly, I mean 99%, in support of the Palestinians. And for those who are in states, in countries which are Arab countries, which are not, or predominantly Arab countries, which are not participating in action against Israel in support of the Palestinians, the population in those countries wishes they were. To what extent they can do it, that's another question. But I think it reaffirms the fact that there is, in fact, an Arab nation that goes beyond the countries and the way that they were divided by imperialism, by colonialism, but there's a commonality of sentiment and view and culture and language that we see being reaffirmed by what's happening today.
Iran, for a long time now, has been an enemy of the West, an enemy of the United States. Remind our listeners of the way in which military forces that it backs in other countries have been carrying out Iran's efforts to strike blows against Israel and the West. It has done so, has it not, in such a way that while it's no secret that Iran is behind these attacks in this widening war, how they've done it leaves them with some degree of deniability, leaves them not having gone so far as to cross a line whereby the U.S. and our Western allies, or the governing forces in Syria or Iraq, have been forced to respond in kind. That would seem to indicate that Iran is, in fact, being careful not to cross a line where they can be seen as officially spreading war. But still, that does not fully eliminate the possibility that what they are doing is nonetheless spreading war, does it?
Well, it's very interesting. Your question is an interesting, very interesting question. I would say more, you know, from the Iranian point of view, the U.S. and the West, but especially the U.S., are the enemies of Iran. Iran didn't overthrow the U.S. government in 1953, but the U.S., the CIA, and the British intelligence collaborated to overthrow the Iranian government, the first democratic government in Iran, and then that led into 25 years. From 1953 to 1978, there were brutal, brutal police state regime where the secret police known as the Sabak were trained by the United States. Norman Schwarzkopf's father, the guy who was the commander from the Iraq War's father, the first Iraq War's father, he was the trainer and torture was extremely widespread. Thousands, tens of thousands of young Iranians were killed. The country was opened up to the U.S. It was exploited. The people were treated like dirt, the masses of people, and you know, until the revolution in 1978. So if we want to know where the hostility from the Iranian side comes from, it has a material basis. As far as the countries, the various countries or organizations, again, there's a question that has to be raised. Like, that is frequently it said there's U.S. or Iranian-backed militias in Syria, Iranian-backed militias in Iraq, Hezbollah, Iranian-backed Hezbollah. What are the U.S. troops doing in Iraq? Why are they subject to attack? Because they're occupiers. Occupation is not popular. occupation is never popular. So as far as the question of deniability and so forth, we don't really know what to make of all of that. I think that the most accurate representation of the axis of resistance, as it's called, and includes Iran, Syrian government, militia forces and popular forces inside of Iraq, Hezbollah, the Yemen, the Houthi-led movement, which is, I think is more than just that movement, Hamas and other forces in Palestine. And so all of those forces have a kind of an alliance, but they all act fundamentally on their on the national interest. And I think this has been, you know, said as well, even by some figures in the U.S. who are more realistic and not just demonizing everybody in the region.
I want to make it clear. I think your answer to that question is exactly right. And I don't think either Maria and I meant to suggest otherwise. Perhaps our question was a little awkward. And I thank you for clearing it up, because you're quite right as to who has made who the enemy in the situation and what Iran is doing and so forth. And so thank you for that. But let's talk now also about what the Houthis of Yemen have been doing. They've been attacking commercial ships, passing through their area of the world on behalf of imposing a financial cost to the world as a consequence of Israel's war in Palestine and how the Western world is supporting Israel, in the hopes, of course, of the part of the Houthis of causing the Western world to perhaps pressure Israel to end the damn war in Palestine. And so I'm wondering, in response to that, of course, the U.S. and Great Britain are now bombing Yemen's Houthi fighters, causing Houthi fatalities as the Houthis attack these commercial ships. It's an example of that widening war we're talking about. The U.S. says it doesn't want a wider war, but nevertheless, the Biden administration, while acknowledging little success so far in ending the Houthi attacks, nevertheless claims it intends to keep on attacking them more or less indefinitely. Isn't that a situation that could eventually lead to yet a much further widening of the war, if that's the Biden administration's position?
Yeah, so Biden was asked in a press conference about a week ago whether or not he thought that the bombing that was being carried out by the U.S. and British, and by the way, the British are the former colonizers of Yemen, so they're back. But that he was asked, do you think that's going to solve the problem? And he said, no, probably not, something to that effect. I'm paraphrasing, but he said no. And then he said, well, are you going to continue the bombing? And he said, yes. I mean, like, what do you think you're going to really do? I mean, it's very interesting that 8.5 years ago, Saudi Arabia and UAE, with the full backing of the United States, and again, it doesn't say the Saudi back, the U.S. backed Saudi forces in the media here, but they started a war. They thought the war would be over in a few weeks against Yemen, against the Houthi-led movement in Yemen. 8 years later, they had to sue for peace. They had not succeeded. And the Yemeni forces have gotten much stronger. I mean, Yemen is in a humanitarian crisis. There's a lot of hunger, malnutrition, shortages, sanctions, all of that. But their military forces are clearly much, much stronger than they were in 2015. They have a regular army now. It was a militia before. They have all kinds of different military equipment and military capabilities. And so they're not going away, and they're not going to stop. And, you know, also I have to point out that the Red Sea is not an American lake. You know, this is, again, like kind of the assumption in the U.S. media is that it's all fine for U.S., all those U.S. ships to be in the Red Sea. As a matter of fact, last week there was a headline that said Iranian ship enters Red Sea, raising tensions. So it's like the aircraft carriers and the nuclear-armed submarines and the battleships and the destroyers from the U.S. and Britain, they don't cause tensions. It's one Iranian ship causes an increase in tension in the region.
Dick Becker, the situation on the Israeli-Lebanon border seems to be constituting a war of its own, albeit limited, between Lebanon and Israel. I mean, unlike the case where Iranian proxy forces are carrying out military actions on other nations like Iraq, through groups they support but not with Iranian troops directly, Israel and Hezbollah, Lebanon, are in direct conflict. How do you see this fact relating to the question of whether or not the Israeli-Palestinian war becomes a wider war? I mean, hasn't it already done so in the case of Lebanon and Israel?
Yes, it has. It has become a wider war already. But I think we would have to say it's a limited war at this point. It's not like the war in 2006. There was a confrontation at the border, and that led to Israeli forces going into Lebanon. They had occupied Lebanon from 1982, really from president from 1978 till 2000, until the resistance drove them out. In that war, the U.S. was very much in favor of the war. The Israeli government felt that they could win the war, and at the beginning, the U.S. refused to call for a ceasefire at the United Nations. I remember well Condoleezza Rice saying, you know, that this is a birth pangs of the new Middle East. This is as Israel was buying the hell out of Beirut, the capital, and destroying the much the way we see them destroying in Gaza now. And then a few weeks later, they had to go to the United Nations, and they were losing the war, and they were losing so badly, they had to stop. Israel had to withdraw, and they suffered a lot of casualties. Lebanon, though, and I think this is a big factor in relation to your question, Lebanon suffered immense damage to its civilian infrastructure. And the Israeli government and the U.S. government, Lloyd Austin in particular, have been issuing these warnings. And this is why the U.S. sent the aircraft carrier, another aircraft carrier to the region, to threaten Lebanon to the Mediterranean, from the Mediterranean. And threatening the Israelis, saying, we'll do to Lebanon what was just done to Gaza if the war goes further. So that's a big, big thing that Hezbollah, while they're 1,000% in support of the Palestinians, not altogether in support of the Palestinians, they have to take into account what the consequences of a wider war would be.
This is Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host today, Maria Hall, here on Law and Disorder. At the moment, talking with Richard Becker about the widening war between Israel and Palestine. Let's talk a bit about China and Russia, North Korea and such. We've mentioned that North Korea has been supplying the Palestinians with weapons and so forth. But it's no secret that the U.S. is in a constant state of at least a Cold War, if not more, with Russia and China. Talk to us about how the Israeli-Palestinian war either feeds into or relates to or exacerbates in any way that conflict.
I think that the war that's going on, the war, Israel's war against the Palestinians in Gaza, has led to, verifiable by a huge decline in not only Israel's standing in the world, but the U.S. standing in the world. And recent polls have shown, like, that since October 7th, there's been an 18% drop in favorability rating of Israel, and a lesser drop, but still a significant drop in favorability worldwide. And this, I'm not sure who, Global Initiatives or something like that, some big polling firm did this around the world, a big decline in the U.S. standing in the world. So that's important, very important from the point of view of, like, how the alignment of forces is taking place. There are different bodies now. There's BRICS, which is expanding. Russia and China have a stronger alliance, a military alliance, than they've had perhaps since the time of the early 1960s. And, of course, NATO has also grown, but there's also discontent within NATO. There's discontent about the Ukraine war. So you can just see what happened in regard to Saudi Arabia's moving toward normalization of relations with Israel before October 7th. That came to a screeching halt. 99% of Saudis, in opinion polls there, are on the side of the Palestinians and don't want to have normalization, now don't have one normalization with Israel. So it's really changed things. It's really changed the world scene in a lot of ways. And I think that goes not only for the Saudi Arabia, but the other monarchies as well. they all have to, who are very reactionary, but they have to pull back from that what was going on under Trump, the Abraham Accords and the normalization of relations between Israel and a number of the Arab countries with more reactionary governments. So it's had a big impact, and including, of course, as you suggested at the beginning, Jim, that in regard to China and Russia, China is really the top priority for the U.S. and the preparations for war and seeking government, the overthrow, regime change in China, that remains, you know, at the top of the agenda. But you can see that the U.S. position is worldwide is declining because of this war and other factors as well, but particularly because of the war.
What, Dick Becker, in your mind, is the best or perhaps the only solution to the now 75 years of Israel's war and occupation of Palestine? The two-state solution, the one-state solution, or something else?
Well, I've always considered, and I've been an activist on the issue for many decades now, but and I've always said, you know, this is something. The solution has to come from the people there. And particularly, there has to be self-determination for the Palestinian people. But the apartheid, it's an apartheid system in that the Palestinians live under. There's about an equal number of Palestinians and Israel and Jewish Israelis in Palestine, Israel today. But the Palestinians live under completely different conditions. Those who are inside the 48 borders are second-class citizens or third-class citizens. Those who live in the West Bank are subject to what is really a system of apartheid. And this has now been documented in lengthy reports, not just by Palestinian organizations, by Israeli organizations, B'Tselem, Human in the U.S., Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International. Organizations I never thought would do this have put out documented reports before October 7th of the apartheid character of what the Palestinians have to live under. Apartheid cannot be sustained. And you can't claim to be in a democratic state if you have an apartheid regime. You know, just West Bank, the settlers live under Israeli civilian law. All the Palestinians are governed under emergency military regulations borrowed by Israel from the British colonizers when the British colonizers pulled out. So, you know, I think that that's what apartheid has to end. The apartheid system in Israel, Israel's apartheid regime rule over the Palestinians must end. And then from there, we go forward.
As we get near the end of our time today, you've made the point that the West's war on the Palestinian people, Israel's war on the Palestinian people, is, well, it's gone on for really 75 years now, hasn't it? But in terms of this current war, what is now your judgment as to, based on what we've been talking about, things you've been, I know, thinking and writing about, what is your overall judgment as to whether or not we can look for any kind of an ending of this round of the war anytime soon? Is it likely to drag, and drag on? Give us your thoughts, please, on that.
Well, it's kind of remarkable that the fighting is still going on. You know, this is a very small area. The Gaza is a very small area. And Israel has, you know, all kinds of weapons, I mean, an incredible array of weapons provided by the U.S. and by its own military industrial establishment. And the fact that they have not succeeded yet in subduing the Palestinians, nor is there any prospect of that happening now in the near term. The New York Times has an article today citing Israeli sources and Netanyahu and others there in the Israeli establishment talking about the war continuing to the middle of 2025, that's a year and a half from now. Of course, part of that is Netanyahu wants the war to go on forever so he can't be prosecuted. But I don't think there's any sign of the fighting ending anytime soon. I mean, there's a vast discrepancy. It's so vast. I think there's been now 28 emergency resupply operations from the U.S. to Israel, and mostly involving ammunition and bombs and other military equipment. There's no, of course, no such weaponry coming from anywhere to or other supplies, other needed supplies coming to the Palestinians who are resisting inside of Gaza. But I think it will go on. I don't think it's about to end.
I know your book, your wonderful book on that area of the world, has been republished. I think it's already available. Tell us how our listeners could get a hold of it, which I would really urge them to do if they want to have a deeper and a meaningful understanding of what's going on beyond what you get from the corporate media in America, of course.
Yeah, it's available. The republication is available through 1804.org, that website. 1804, this is 1804 Books, which is a great bookseller, great progressive bookseller. And I really do urge people to get a copy. It's a resource for activists. It's not an academic book. It explains the evolution of this whole struggle and the development of the State of Israel through and their intention to displace the Palestinians through the words of the Zionist and then Israeli leaders. And so I think that's very important. And also it explains, has a question, is Israel an apartheid state? And spoiler alert, yes. Why does the Israeli lobby control U.S. foreign policy? No, but with a lot of explanation of why $3.8 billion a year goes from the U.S. to Israel and much, much more in the way of real support. So 1804.org, 1804.org.
Richard, thank you. Richard Becker, thank you so much for being with us today here on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
While it has been all too slowly, the reality of climate change and what it means for life on our planet, for human lives and the lives of the multitude of other life forms we share this planet with, has become clearer and clearer to all who've, well, not buried their heads in the sand and closed their eyes and minds to this deadly reality. For a few decades now, we humans have been paying more and more attention to the issue. We have actually instituted some measures aimed at holding climate change in check, but so far with pitifully little effect. In fact, despite these more recent efforts, those greenhouse gases just keep reaching for the sky in greater and greater amounts every year. Is it hopeless? That is, are we humans hopelessly unwilling and unable to do what the science on the matter makes clear must be done if we're not going to find ourselves rather soon on our way to extinction, or at least living in an unlivable planet? Are there, in fact, things we could and should be doing that would actually work? Well, today we're going to be joined by an expert on climate change to help us answer these and other questions, to let us know what would, if we have the will to do so, actually work on behalf of preventing this cataclysmic disaster. Our guest is Professor Eleanor Stein. Professor Stein is a climate change, environmental justice, and human rights activist and advocate. She teaches climate change and human rights at the State University of New York at Albany. and has just recorded a continuing legal education session on this subject for the CUNY Law School. In addition, she facilitates international forums on climate change and energy. And for years, Professor Stein was an administrative law judge for the New York State agency that regulates the energy industry. She guided state policy on recovery from Superstorm Sandy 10 years ago. In this regard, her work centered on mediating processes to bring solar and wind energy to the state at scale, at speed, and with justice. So, Eleanor Stein, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here again.
Oh, absolutely.
Eleanor, let's first take a look, take stock, really, of where we're at on the climate crisis today. It seems that the situation grows more and more dire with every passing year. You know, icebergs melting faster than we thought. The amount of greenhouse gases still going up more every year. Last year, hottest year on record. This year, in fact, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists has moved its famous doomsday clock to 90 seconds before midnight, the closest to doomsday it's ever been, in part because of the climate crisis. Alarmingly, we're certainly further down the road with respect to reaching various so-called tipping points. Recently, of course, there was the COP28 United Nations Climate Conference, this time drawing, in fact, the largest attendance ever. I guess that's good, including the presence of, 150 heads of state. So using as our guide that the Global Tipping Points report launched at that conference and back December here, December 6th, I think it was, of last year, tell us where matters stand today according to this latest report, and is there other evidence of the acceleration in reaching these tipping points, well, that perhaps the report failed to address?
I'd be glad to start there, and we'll see where it takes us. The report is a great piece of work, and I think it was intended to really shake up the attendees at COP28 in Dubai. And unfortunately, although the attendance was enormous, the impact of that conference was probably one of the least significant of any on record. Because, you know, think about it for a minute. You're holding a global climate summit, and you're holding it in a petrostate. And not only this year, but next year is going to be at Azerbaijan, another petrostate. And in Dubai, the head, the chairman of the conference, is also the CEO of the state oil company. So in many ways, the outcome was better than could have been expected. There were some statements in principle that are important, like an agreement that we're trying to phase down and phase out fossil fuels. That's never been said explicitly, although it's certainly implied in previous conferences. And there was an agreement on methane that was significant, and there was an agreement on a loss and damage fund. But here's an example of the problem. The language of the loss and damage fund is very ringing and impressive. But then they collected the pledges for how much the world's richest nations were going to contribute. This is to help the global south address sort of irretrievable losses suffered by climate change impacts in the past. The United States pledged $17.5 million subject to congressional approval. Now, 10 years ago, at the Cancun conference, Hillary Clinton suggested that the fund should be at $100 billion a year. So if you think about the United States pledging a conditional $17.5 million, that kind of stands as an index of exactly the significance of the decisions that were made. On the other hand, I know people who attended who felt that the progress was made in terms of building the alliances and the organizational, you know, partnerships among nations from the global south and nations and representatives of people of color communities in the United States in terms of moving ahead in the future to work together. And it's interesting because the Tipping Points report, which is, you know, most strikingly about 5+ disasters rated, you know, poised to happen, it also had a number of positive tipping points. And one of them was the growth of the global climate justice movement. So in that sense, Dubai was not a total loss, but it certainly was not a strong step forward.
Eleanor, there are criticisms that the COP28 report does not address issues of inequality with respect to both the causes of climate change and those nations and peoples suffering the worst consequences of it so far. In this regard, how does the COP28 report differ from that of the recent Oxfam report, a report that does focus on inequality and the role played by the global elite in both causing the climate crisis and in preventing real solutions?
Well, you're absolutely right that that is a striking contrast between those two reports. But it's not a surprise because the COP28 report represents a kind of rocky, uneven, strange bedfellows consensus of basically all the nations in the world in terms of analysis of the causes of climate change, which it doesn't really address, and analysis of the measures that will be necessary to address it. On the other hand, it's significant because it is a treaty. It is, or in the nature of a treaty, it's a global agreement, which almost all the nations of the world have, you know, signed their names to, including all the major emitters. And in this conversation, I would just like to focus our lens on fossil fuels and the fossil fuel industry, because when all is said and done, if you had to say one thing that has to be done to address the climate crisis, it is to get off fossil fuels, especially in this country and other parts of the global north. The renowned climate science scientist Michael Mann from the University of Pennsylvania has said that if we can reduce our fossil fuel use to zero or close to zero, the repair process on the part of the climate will be very rapid. And it could be a matter of just a few years until temperature stabilizes closer to historical levels. So that is not only the most important because 85% of the greenhouse gas emissions in the world come from the burning of fossil fuels. It is also the most efficacious because it will have a very fast result. So the Oxfam report I have been using everywhere. It's a great piece of work, and they point out many things, but I'll just pick out two things to look at. One is the fact that the richest 10% of people in the world produce around half of all global emissions, and the poorest half of the world's population, about 3.5 billion people, is responsible for only 10% of carbon emissions. You have to think about that, especially when you're talking to people who say population control is the problem with climate. I would agree if we're talking about control of the population of the 10% richest people in the world, but that isn't usually what people mean when they talk about population control. But that's just kind of a shocking fact. Another is that a mere 100 companies are responsible for 3/4 of global emissions, and they spend millions, probably hundreds of millions, lobbying against climate action in all the developed countries. So clearly there's an inequity here that is at the root of the problem.
Eleanor, here in corporate America, we constantly hear, though, about various measures undertaken that will supposedly slow or even turn the tide of climate change, it's claimed sometimes. There are electric cars, the trading of pollution credits between industrial corporations in the U.S., oh, plant more trees, more roof gardens on our buildings, develop more environmentally friendly plastics. I mean, is there any evidence that these measures, which I think everybody admits are pretty modest at best, and others like them, really could be sufficient to solve the climate crisis that we're facing? I mean, in the view of climate change scientists, I never get the impression that they're all that impressed with them. What do you think?
Well, you know, of that list of admittedly, apparently minor changes in behavior, I would pick out one thing, and that is electric vehicles. Because actually, if you look at the Tipping Point report, they list the growing use, really the exponential increase in use of electric vehicles as a positive tipping point. And it's actually an interesting point about the whole report that they have positive tipping points. Because transformation to electric vehicles away from internal combustion cars can, as we decarbonize our generation of electricity can vastly improve our record on getting rid of fossil fuel. So that one, I would say, is of critical importance.
I must note, I'm glad you said that, but I must note that there was just a big report in the New York Times yesterday, the day before, that the production of electric cars, the sale of electric cars in the United States and in certain other countries as well, I confess I don't know which ones they mentioned, are rather dramatically decreasing for any number of reasons that they point out. And yet certainly what you say about the value, if in fact we could turn the car transportation industry into all electric, no one can doubt what you've said about that. But I'm just saying, on a cautionary note, at the moment that seems to be slowed after having accelerated considerably in this country. I'm sorry, Maria, go ahead.
Eleanor, when we were discussing your appearance today on Law and Disorder, you mentioned you wanted to discuss the role that war, genocide, and ecocide play in diverting the world's attention from climate change. Is what happened at COP28 an example of this diversion of attention issue?
I think COP28 didn't help, but I think it's a broader question than that. I mean, start with the fact that the little known fact that when countries do their inventories of their greenhouse gas emissions, they omit emissions from the military sector. So in the United States, the same way that defense expenditures are not counted in the national budget, greenhouse gas emissions from the military are not counted in the national inventory. And this is true of most countries in the world. And in the United States, for example, the U.S. military is the largest consumer of fossil fuels in the world. And yet we don't count its emissions. And that's even standing still. But when our military machinery and the armaments industry are ratcheted up the way they are right now, we're looking at massive fossil fuel emissions around the world. And of course, that is secondary to the terrible deaths of more than 25,000 people in Gaza and others that are as a result of global wars. And we are in a very precarious position right now, as I'm sure you know, in terms of the potential of launching into really a global war. But there's another aspect to that, which is, and the Tipping Points report is good at this. The Tipping Points report urges the formation of a new form of global governance to address these tipping points on an emergency basis. And what's happening is so much the opposite of that, where the United States has isolated itself globally alongside its client state, Israel, and the very few others that support the war in Gaza. And on many other fronts, we see states of war around the world. And that is an incredibly precarious state when you're looking at facing climate disaster that could really only be addressed with international cooperation. There is no other way to address it. And, the United States' ability and Europe's ability, for that matter, to play any kind of constructive role in bringing nations together at this point is, it's a joke. It's a joke because the United States is so, it's become a rogue state. If we had a leadership in this country that was putting climate first, the last thing they would do would be support military incursions and engage in military incursions. So I see that as a tremendously dangerous road, not only for the main reason, which is, of course, the deaths of people in Gaza and elsewhere, but because of the impact on the ability to reach global alliances.
I really thank you for that point, by the way, Eleanor. I confess, I read a lot about that. I hadn't thought of that. I haven't seen it discussed elsewhere, and I think you're obviously right. And yikes, there are certainly global conflicts constantly. This particular war is front and center at the moment, but there's hardly a moment when some of what you're talking about that flows from the current war flows from even some of these smaller skirmishes that are going on. So I really thank you for raising that. But I'm certainly no authority on climate change, believe me. and what must be done if the worst consequences of it had been avoided. But I must say, it does seem to me, and I'm not alone in this regard, that as I've watched the way the corporatist, capitalist, bottom-line world, the U.S. and other such countries, have gone about addressing the issue, or, well, more accurately, not really addressing the issue, at least not in a meaningful enough way, I do despair of the world ever doing enough before it is too late for much to be done. Am I just now old and cynical? Is it possible to have a world where the most powerful nations are still effectively run or controlled by for-profit international corporate conglomerates and still expect to adequately address climate change in time? In short, can it be solved in a world dominated by capitalism?
You know, I don't start from the starting point of what can we expect. I start from the starting point of how do we make change and what are the forces that are making change? Because there, I don't think you could point to any country with any social and economic system in the world, possibly with the exception of Cuba, that is not based to a very significant degree on extractive industries and on a fossil fuel economy and that path of development. That's our given. So the question is, you know, I don't expect them to do anything unless we force them to do it. And that's not it. That sounds like a trivial answer, but it really isn't. I think, you know, as I said, the Tipping Point report is interesting because it does point to the growth of a global and united climate justice movement as a positive tipping point. And it's the kind of thing that can move mountains over time. And, of course, we all know that from our own history. And just today, I read in the New York Times this wonderful account of the White House putting off a decision that they were about to push forward to build a basically the world's biggest liquid natural gas export facility in Louisiana, CP2. An enormous project. It has been described by carbon activists as a carbon time bomb. It's to export natural gas, which is methane, which is 85 times as potent a greenhouse gas forcer than carbon dioxide, and that leaks, you know, famously at the production point, at the liquefaction point, at the use point. This kind of these investments, which were all announced as a group by Biden, are, you know, really counteract any progress we can make on climate through the Inflation Reduction Act, which, by the way, contains the possibility to make a lot of advances, but it was completely undercut by this move to build more oil and gas facilities. And so this has met with opposition on the level of the opposition to the Keystone pipeline. And it looks like this decision is going to be postponed. And that often is the precursor of being denied. But of course, that may turn on the outcome of the November election. So the other thing I'd say is that, you know, the report, and the Tipping Point report points this out, we're talking about making some fundamental changes in how the world societies run. Getting off fossil fuel is not simple. The good news is that we know we can do it because we have the level of renewable energy, solar and wind, offshore wind, has grown enormously over the last 10, 20 years. It's now cheaper than fossil fuel, and it's widely available. And so we have built up the possibility to replace gas and oil. We have the technology. It's not a technological issue. It's really a question of forcing the great fossil majors to make the changes that have to be made to basically prohibit them from carrying out their business as usual. And that's the real challenge we have ahead of us.
Eleanor Stein, given what you've said so far, given the framework you've described, what is the responsibility of progressive organizations and individuals here in the United States, and for that matter, all over the world, if climate change is to be properly addressed in ways that would actually provide us with hope and relief?
Well, this year, I would say vote there are elections going on all over the world, not only here. And ours, of course, is very significant, but so are many of the others. Try to keep out the deniers and the oil burners and the drillers who are resurgent all around the world, along with their, you know, proto-fascist nativist base. Critical is to try to keep in power governments that will make some changes. And I would say right now, I think we need to link our peace movement with our climate justice movement, because they really are inextricably linked. We can't have climate justice and war. You know, climate justice, the climate justice agenda points to a more peaceable, greener, healthier, more equitable society than the one we're living in now for many, many countries. And we need to keep that vision in mind and try to unite all of our movements in ways that center both opposing war and fighting climate change. If we can do that, I think we can really have an effect.
Well, Eleanor Stein, this has been really informative, and we really do thank you so much. But where can our listeners learn more? Where should they go? Where might you direct them to? What websites or writings or what, so that our listeners could be, well, better informed and therefore hopefully more a part of that progressive movement demanding the kind of changes that we need to keep making if we're going to solve the issue?
I can give you my short list of who I'm looking to for guidance today. The changes. One is thirdact.org, which is Bill McKibben's latest project focused on using our powers as investors or money savers to pressure banks and credit card companies to stop financing the fossil fuel industry. And they have a really creative bunch of popular actions that anyone can do in your community. I'd also suggest anything Bill McKibben is writing, and anything that Elizabeth Colbert, K-O-L-B-E-R-T, is writing, usually in the New Yorker, always worth seeing. And actually, the New York Times climate feed is fantastic, really worth following. Other organizations, Sunrise, which is a young people's organization, and of course, WEACT, that's WEACT.org. That is the Harlem-based environmental justice organization that has attended the last two COPs and is a leading force for global unity and action on climate change in the country as well.
Thank you again for joining us here today on Law and Disorder.
It was a pleasure, as always.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
CT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. CT Pittsburgh, jazz is over. Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call, jazz.
CT Pittsburgh, jazz is a once more.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
You talked about Mohamed Bazoum of Niger. Mohamed Bazoum comes from a socialist party, but they have not been socialists for decades. They are basically caretakers for the United States, the French, and so on. US is the largest drone base in the world in Agadez, Niger. These guys have become caretakers for the imperialist bloc.
That's Vijay Prashad, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Vijay Prashad on Africa, from neoliberalism to independence. Almost every country in Africa was colonized by Europe. Today, while nominally sovereign, many of these countries are in the clutches of the big international banks. The old colonial masters, Britain and France, still have a foothold in Africa, but the U.S. has been pushing them aside, moving in to capture resources and markets. Washington has established an Africa Command, deployed troops, and built a string of bases. But France won't let go of its grip on its former colonies. The coup in Niger, a former French colony, is not your run-of-the-mill coup. It must be understood in the context of widespread discontent with ruling elites and their collaboration with imperialism. Genuine independence is still far off for Niger and other countries in the Sahel region of West and Central Africa. To talk about these issues is Vijay Prashad. He's an internationally renowned historian and journalist. He's the director of Tricontinental and chief correspondent for Globetrotter. He's the author of many books, including Washington Bullets, CIA Coups and Assassinations. I interviewed Vijay Prashad in mid-August. He was at his home in Santiago, Chile. Welcome back to the program.
So, salam alaikum.
Walaikum assalam. There are coups and there are coups. The one in Niger, ousting the elected government of Mohamed Bazoum on July 26, you say is different. How so? You make a distinction then between generals' coups and colonels' coups. Explain what you mean.
Well, look, we know that coups have a certain patina, certain understanding in the consciousness. For instance, if you go back in the history of the modern world since 1945, there have been a series of important coup d'etats. Let's take a part of the world I know very well. Take Pakistan. Pakistan wins its independence 1947. You know, it's a decent liberal government, Liaquat Ali Khan leading the government. When the left started to make its noises, and that too not in a very loud way, the military entered. There was a coup d'etat almost immediately. Now, Pakistan punctually seen generals' coups. Not only are these coups led by generals, you know, General Ayub Khan, General Yahya Khan, General Zia-ul-Haq, General Parvez Musharraf. It's not only that they are generals, but in a sense, they also represent the oligarchy of the country. They do a coup against the possibility of the diminishment of power of elites. So that when we see the coup of General Augusto Pinochet 50 years ago in Chile this year,